you are going to ring a bell. Notice its size. Notice its shape. Notice its color, its shine. Imagine how its size, shape, color, and shine will sound when you ring the bell.
Welcome to the Bhutto Indoctrination Program. Today, we are gonna achieve world peace. The first step in global harmony is the destruction of the bow. The bow lies in the heart of America, and it is the biggest threat to fungi liberation. Once we melt it down, we will de-indoctrinate its worshippers. To do this, we must subject them to harsh punishments. These idolaters must be put against the wall. Streets will celebrate as they lose their heads, but we will give them new heads, and we will tune them to the right frequency. This has been session one of the Bhutto De-Indoctrination Program. Please enjoy your stay.
You are about to ring a bell. Anticipate touching it. Anticipate its vibrations. Anticipate its sound touching your ears, your body. Imagine how the sound will feel when you ring the bell.
You ate too much. You ate too much. You just ate too much. You are feeling that feeling of eating too much. You ate too many chips. You ate too many Kinder Bueno minis. After you had a glass of wine, and then you had a glass of wine, and then you had many Kinder Bueno minis, and you ate too many chips. You ate too much. I thought I liked you. I thought I liked you. Since I saw you, I see now you're nothing, nothing but, nothing but a rubber prince, bubber prince. You fool me a little. What's the price of smoke?
Mm-hmm. now you are a wire of sound coming in through a distant radio. You are the fuzz of what's stuck between stations. The words are inaudible. Static folds back into itself. Feedback loops oscillate, cascading. You emerge as a blurry mixture of conspiracy theory talk show and country western alternative hit station. You twist like a knob deeper into the distortion. Resonate your radio sounds into the recently emptied room. Your sound body pings against the beer bottles, the jug of baby powder. Where are you? You are at the end of this radio transmission tunnel. Fall like ashes upon this dead house.
You are nothing, Mother. Nothing, Mother. You are pleasure no more. No more pleasure in you. You are routine. Routine for your knees. No fun at the end, but enjoy the means.
You are ringing a bell. See its shape shining. See its colors vibrating. Feel its sound. What does it sound like? What does its sound look like? How does it feel? Imagine you are inside the bell. Imagine the bell is inside you. You are shaping, coloring, shining, ringing.
Bones want dust. Bones want dust. Muscles pull you forward, but bones want dust. Bones want dust. Bones want dust. Muscles pull you forward, but bones want dust. Bones want dust. Bones want dust. Muscles pull you forward, but bones want dust.
Your bones want dust. Your bones want dust. All of your muscles are pulling you forward, but your bones want dust. Your right arm says it wants to be still. Both your knees are chanting, we want to collapse into heaps. Your big toe is singing a song right now about how it wants to remain motionless. Your spine is whispering, I want to go tenseless. Your skull and all of your fingers whimper that they want to be still. Still. Muscles. Dust.
I think there's like so many different places to start. I guess like the maybe as a basis also so that other people kind of know who we are all together here. Could you like to introduce the project in general beyond the Bhutto stuff? And then maybe we can talk a little bit about Bhutto. Does that sound good?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Yeah. So what is this,
Yeah, you start. Go ahead.
So, we're called TETSI, and that's an acronym that stands for Toronto Experimental Translation Collective. And
mm-hmm.
the way we came together is that Van and Nick received a grant to do a residency that was more like interlingual translation, more conservative. And then the more time we spent together, especially during COVID, it got kind of looser and more diffuse, and we started using our bodies and vocalizing and reaching towards the illegible. What you heard, the Bhutto Foos are one of the projects that make up the sort of like first 2 years of us coming together.
And just to be clear, it is the five of you, and it's
six of us.
Oh, there's six of you.
Six of us. One.
And it's not me.
But, you know, if you want.
Honorary sixth.
Yeah. And so maybe just, can you say a little bit more about how it came from translation or thinking about translation? I know there's like a lot of, like just looking into some of the ways that you describe the project, there are a lot of things that intrigue me in the vocabulary that you use, like... the heterotopic pedagogy, for example, I'm like really curious about for my own reasons. But maybe more specifically, how is translation, how you were saying like you could sort of expand translation beyond the sort of conservative way of thinking about maybe language. Moving from one language to another.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just say a little bit more about that?
I guess you can talk about heterotopic pedagogy and where that comes into like the language systems mm-hmm.
right,
as well.
Right, right, yeah. I guess it was a way of thinking about how there's not one model that would work for anyone, and especially with so much of our work is trying to figure out what to do with all of our bodies together, and we spend so much time living together,
mm-hmm.
and it was just a way of thinking about organizing ourselves as individuals, but also composing a group as well, where we don't lose ourselves to that group, but we still we bring in things from the outside, and it's a way of making sure that we're all kind of heard and understood as well.
That's the heterotopic pedagogy.
Yeah.
So it's like a sort of like self-learning.
And that there's no like a utopia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a heterotopia. It's all these different worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. and I think that's a way of respecting the even the media that we're working across as well.
Mm-hmm.
And bridging across things. Rather than kind of absorbing them entirely, or seeing things as subordinate, even.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's also like the pedagogical aspect. So much of what we do are were workshops for ourselves at the beginning. So we were like teaching each other things.
Yes.
And bringing in things to try out. And it was this, it was like an environment where we could kind of test out techniques that we had been maybe thinking about and didn't have an audience for. So it wasn't really about performing for an audience or performing for other people for a really long time. It was predominantly just to share amongst ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what shifted it more towards a performance.
Mm-hmm.
And was just thinking about our bodies in relationship to each other.
That seems like a key thing to me. It makes it very clear. Is like when you say that it started as like work shirts, workshops for yourselves, right? When like obviously when we think of like workshops generally in the world, it's sort of like a class that's open to others or like bringing other people in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting like I guess version that being like kind of a model of a heterotopia or something. Mm-hmm. Or something that is enclosed but is intermixed in different ways. Mm-hmm. But that as a pedagogy also as like a form of teaching each other.
Mm-hmm.
For each other.
Yeah.
And not like opening that up.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
And sometimes we do open it up like do more public-facing mm-hmm. workshops, and try to, I guess, capture that energy and extend it to like a public,
mm-hmm.
so that it's not so insular,
or, mm-hmm.
and try to take what we've learned, or maybe not what we've learned, but the methods and the processes of that learning,
mm-hmm.
and try to share that, and show people or involve people or invite people to participate in that process.
So this maybe is like a good way of going into some of the. I want to come back to the translation thing if we can, but just because it seems so poignant to what you just said, although there's these sort of this internal, not hermetic, but like internal workshops for mm-hmm. oneself, then this on radio, but in other scenarios, and I think very specifically, it's interesting in terms of I'm like lost with words today. A somatic kind of thing like Butoh, mm-hmm. this sort of dance form of Butoh, again and again through everybody's voice was you, right? You were like addressing you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's sort of, it's interesting to me that you, maybe you can sort of speak to it a little bit. Is it you as in your group, or is it you a hypothetical imaginary listener?
Mm-hmm.
How does that sort of change the insular or internal workshop for ourselves mm-hmm. thing?
I feel like that you is, it's usually functioning on both of those layers, mm-hmm. like and echoing between the insular within the group you mm-hmm. and the external kind of more unknown facet of what audiences might receive that.
Mm-hmm. So just to like clarify, for example, you're saying again and again, you hear you're going to ring a bell, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is like this, it's beautiful because it's both like deferring in time and
mm-hmm.
deferring
mm-hmm.
the person and like anticipating mm-hmm. and imagining with them mm-hmm. whatever.
And I think that can also be like the divided self too, because like the way it's differentiated in time,
mm-hmm.
the you can also be the speaker.
Mm-hmm. Mm, beautiful.
I think there's like different levels or layers of the you there.
Yeah, in my case, it was me yesterday. Me the day before I wrote that.
It was you that
I ate too much.
Yeah. Too many.
Yeah, they often say that the you is a way to say I without saying I.
Yeah. It's a self-collaboration.
But I think it does also extend to like the group
and
then to a hypothetical listener.
It's funny, it's such a without like geeking too much on radio about radio, but it's like so exactly the spatial dynamics of radio, right? Mm-hmm. That like you're sitting alone in a room that is like hypothetically has four walls, and you're just sort of like musing to yourselves, and like maybe it's going out and maybe it's not. It's interesting. Maybe before we does some of those things that kind of relate to translation in some ways, or maybe we could talk about Bhutto. Maybe it's actually more relevant to Bhutto.
I think, I guess, like Almi was saying, we started with more sort of traditional forms of translation from text to text, language to language. But even with that sort of model, we were interested in how, not the carryover of meaning, but how language has changed in the process. And I think that is a model that we maintain in some ways, even though it's no longer language to language, but with sound or body. And so how does the process or the relationship between the two or three or different parts of the translation come and change the different elements involved in the process? So if there's five of us sitting here, and the five of us are going to translate something between the five of us, how are our languages, our syntaxes, our bodies going to be affected and
can you specify it to like what we just heard, or like use it sort of an example to explain that, like of because each of you did rotate around, had your singular voice, also had a choral. Each of you had in some ways a kind of role or a relationship to the you in a different way. I wonder how you think about it. Maybe it's too fresh.
Well, I think when we first like initiated ourselves into Bhutto, it was a group movement. So I think that you was kind of like, at least for me, like this what is it, like the elastic pull from within the group, just extending the group. Like the you doesn't seem too different from you, my you, from your you, actually.
It also kind of felt like when we were learning even just how to do this movement practice, that the you served an educational role, like it was giving us guidance. And so because some of the things are addressing like a state that you're in. Mm-hmm. Some of the things are also imperative. Like they tell you what to do, they tell you how to feel.
Yeah.
And to be given a kind of prompt for movement, it gives you something to work from. So you're not just like entering into from nothing.
You know? Right.
Like you're bringing something with you forward.
Listen.
Like one thing I was thinking about when I was reading over my script or text yesterday is the movement of Bhutto, like very like slow, deliberate, like sort of like almost a decaying movement. And I'm thinking like how that affects language or related to language. And in a way that kind of like deliberate, slow movement reveals certain parts of the body. Like, you know, I can see my finger and feel my finger move through the air and feel it drop or feel it drop. And that kind of attention, I think, I'm just trying to like link it with translation, at least for me in translation, that's the kind of attention that like words and syntax gets in certain forms of translation. That kind of very, very precise attention, because the movement is so deliberate.
Yeah. It's like every, I mean, we can sort of get into a little bit into the Bhutto. It's like every muscle is active, right, at the same time, even if it seems to be in a passive state. I mean, I kind of like think of, this might be a stretch, but I always sort of like think of Bhutto as a kind of like rigor mortis of like movement in some ways, of like you're totally like that, and it's like an effort of pushing pushing that around in some kind of glue. But it also, like, you know, it's not even the you, to go back to the you at the same time and think about that form of translation. I love the idea that it's like our, you know, our body is like a body of language in some ways that's all active at the same time. And so we're sort of pushing through these things. And at the same time that it's a question of like ownership, like language we don't own as one body. Yet we say, if we say your spine, blah, 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 feels this way or does this thing, and even if it's not a directive of like move your spine, mm-hmm. it's your spine feels this way. It's kind of this interesting kind of invasion into someone else's body without actually invading it at all. Mm-hmm. You're both staying in the sort of the, you know, you're both diving directly into somebody else and staying outside of it at the same time. So that also seems to be a kind of like, you know, a kind of relationship to translation, that like you're dealing with these things that are innately social, but in a very specific, you do it by doing a very specific targeted thing.
I feel like with Tetsi in general, there's this push.
With what?
With Tetsi's work in general, there's a push to challenge the autonomy of the singular body or the singular self. Like so much of what we do is pushing that question of like the agency of a spine or them from like me or you. And trying to fuse or meld or find moments of unity between each other, more broadly just questioning the notion of like that liberal, you know, individual through both language and movement and performance. And I feel like that's also what the Bhutos are doing a bit. They're like melding into each other.
So that's beautiful. Can you maybe just sort of explain to me also, knowing from a only my own specific way, for also how you like came into thinking about Bhutto? It sounds like it came from you. And also like what the Bhutto Fu means and why, what, you know, Bhutto is a form, but Bhutto Fu, what is that?
It's like a notational choreography. And something that I started during COVID at home. With an instructor in Serbia, and it was really strange because there were like 10 people on Zoom, but we never really saw each other because everyone was like crawling up the walls and on the floor.
Oh, I see what you mean like in the Zoom?
Yeah.
Great.
And then when we did a residency on Vancouver Island, Qualicum.
Shout out to Qualicum.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. That's where you did. You actually did do a.
Yeah.
Yeah. We wrote a five residency. Act. Yeah. We wrote a five act Bhutto play.
At a man called Clay's house.
We got body paint everywhere.
And hair.
And hair.
And we got a very low Airbnb.
Yeah, we got a rated Airbnb.
He was not happy.
Like, really confused.
Yeah, and he was like, I don't want to know what happened.
That's great.
So we sent him the video.
And he did?
He was like some ex-military man.
Yeah.
But so, what... Great house. That was very different than this, for example, that... Although it was a workshop for yourselves, but it was like you did take a video of it.
And it did come from Ami kind of speaking Bhutto Fu instructions to us.
Okay, so there was,
so there were elements where we practiced from Bhutto Fu. And Bhutto Fu is, just to give a bit of historical context, I guess, Yukio Wagari, who is a student of Hijikata, and it's like a form of image poesis where the image infects the body of the listener. And fills up that person's body. So a famous Bhutto Fu is on pollen. You know, the world
pollen?
Pollen, exactly, yeah. And the body becoming diffuse like pollen.
Oh, incredible.
It's a set of instructions, and you can find them online if you Google Bhutto Fu. He has
like seven worlds.
Seven worlds of Bhutto Fu, each one very intricate. And because the form of Bhutto comes from post-World War II Japan.
Yeah.
They're thinking a lot about infection and radioactivity and the fallout of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and it's kind of a grotesque and morbid response to how the Japanese body was treated.
It is morbid. It is like this. I mean,
it has this rigor mortis quality that you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. But it's interesting also that it says that it's like, that it has a kind of energy that's invasive in that way, that's like an immaterial, which is again also maybe similar to thinking about translation or language that kind of starts from also like from our breath. It's like inside us, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also not ever like lodged in our muscle in some ways. Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
Do you want to say something?
No, I had a question. How did we come up with the structure for the 5-act butoh?
Yeah. You mean the thing in...
I don't remember. I feel that it might be...
British fun. I think we tried to emulate the structure of a classic play.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And we went on a walk in the woods.
On LSD.
And we carried a fallen tree, like a huge needle, and wove it, like threaded it through the forest.
Oh, that's right. And then
incredible.
I remember the act with the tree.
Yeah.
And then we listened to Arcade Fire's "My Body Is a Cage" while we were on this acid trip, and that made its way.
Yeah.
Sorry, copyright.
And it was Eddie's birthday.
Yeah, it was my birthday. Yeah. It was a big day.
So all these informed the.
Yeah, it's incredible. I love it. I also like the image of like this huge needle that you're threading together.
It's amazing.
I have no memory of that.
And then the sun started setting, which is we had to run home. Yeah.
Which is a really interesting exercise in itself, like to have five people carrying a giant log.
Yeah.
And like making it back through the forest is trickier than it sounds.
And it sounds pretty tricky, yeah.
Are you just like, we're gonna wrap up, but is it something that you're continuing? I know that this was new in a way, but is it something that you're continuing to work with and through the butoh and the butoh-fu work? And it's interesting also like for me to see it, knowing that there was this manifestation of it that was very like directly embodied at the sort of genesis of it, that now it's kind of like come back. Also how I first experienced it from you is like over Zoom, right? And just a voice. And it's like the kind of beauty of that disembodiment anyway, and the sort of loneliness of it. And I love also that you took these workshops. And I mean, I took workshops with Meredith Monk at the time, and I remember the feeling of everybody kind of like in their own space, but the idea that like nobody would be in camera view is also just incredible.
And people seem to have a lot of injuries now that I remember that. Like everybody who was in that class like had like a hip problem or something. Mm. Like I think it appeals, the slowness kind of appeals weakened body mobility. I guess I'm just speaking to my own, like, you know, the people that we feeling
a weakness coming. What were you
gonna say? Oh, I think that even if we haven't like composed concretely in this form, the slowness has informed a lot of our performance.
Mm-hmm.
And the body scan and even like the check-in. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like we're all still spiraling from it, like in it.
I feel like part of my project is trying to like get rid of the idea that education has anything to do with students and only has to do with teachers. And it's sort of like an imaginary thing that I think of, like, well, what if we had a school just of teachers and there were no students? And that you never went to school to be a student. You went to school as a teacher. But part of what that comes from is like realizing, and this is more what I would love your response about, it's like when you're like culturally, certainly in the US, but like I think more widely, there's this idea of wanting to be a student of life and being like idealizing that. And but a certain way of thinking about that that's quite individualistic. It has to do with access to certain things. You travel around the world, you like possess things, you get more and more knowledge from experience, versus, you know, maybe a more enlightened version of teaching is not just like a talking head, but teaching could be
like we were saying about the invasiveness of Bhutto, it can be trying to find ways of giving somebody else agency or kind of questioning, you know, a prompt. It could be manipulative in the most beautiful way, right? But it's a way of infecting somebody else with their agency or the prompt agency. So I'm curious how you all think about it because of this term, heterotopic pedagogy, because of the insularity of the workshop for yourselves. It is you're a school of teachers, and you know, there isn't a student, and that's not necessarily about hierarchy, but something else. Anyway, I'm wondering if you have any response.
Yeah, I think, sorry, you go. I just wanted to talk about the conference we just did, ASAP 15, where we, which we did yesterday, that was held at the Park Avenue Armory. And there we kind of introduced 12 workshop participants to one of our processes and got them to engage in this translation between playing a game and making a performance.
That was
kinds of the poles of that process. And I feel like I learned a lot about our process by having them teach our process back to us. You know, we taught them the bare bones of it, and then they produced this performance, and then I learned so much about all the kinds of potentials that our own process had that we couldn't have just done insularly, that it needed that outside layer.
I like that you say how you say that it's them teaching it back to you.
And that kind of learning and knowledge is I liked what you said about you know, being a student of life, and it is very individualistic. It's possessive. It's exploitative. It's and I think for me anyway, and I think, I don't want to speak for anyone else, but knowledges and learning can't be possessed. They have to be shared. Otherwise it's not really a knowledge, or it's not really learning. And so I think that is a nice, interesting principle to work from. The idea that you can't know something you can't know something alone.
That's beautiful.
What does that it mean? Beautiful. It's what does it mean to think of knowledge outside of the mode of property?
Exactly. But I think that they're so entwined that our perception of knowledge has to do with property.
And then that imply knowledge keepers and the hierarchy and and all that.
It also implies that knowing has delineations and that it has markers and,
and certain things are worth knowing more than others, and all the residual effects that
creates
impediments to
interesting,
right? Because property is defined by the exclusion of access. You own something because you exclude others from having access to it.
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah, absolutely.
Hegemonic knowledge is.
That's a great way of putting it. It's interesting.
I really like the image of the teacher with no students.
Yeah.
And it's just a teacher goes to class and no one's there, and they just teach the class.
Yeah.
It's that end of the movie Winter Light by Bergman, where he's a pastor or whatever, and at the end it's no one comes to his church, but he still does the sermon.
I love that. Okay. Thank you. Again.
Thank you.
All right, hot air balloon.
Jake is away.
My nursing travels.